Forecast. The front on the edge of her map is littered with unfriendly looking spikes and curves. Occluded, she says, her TV charm and tidy hair, a distraction that would make a Holocaust sound pleasant. She chatters on about the loan passing over. Her soporific tone takes the force from the hurricane and tsunami alert. She speaks with John, who is somewhere outside in wet weather gear, shouting down an oversized microphone. This designer-dressed professional delivers her script, flashes sunbeam smiles, and twitches only very slightly when her wall of isodyne is washed away. Thank you.
You guys.
This is your poem, but it's been tweaked. It's called After the Drought, which is written about my time in Mozambique when, after a long drought, the rain to come. And it's from Genesis 1:22. Now, at 1:22 precisely, a portal, a drop, a lover's soft kiss pops. Behind me, you slam shut the Land Rover door. The dull thud cracks, plum purple cloud, a door opening elsewhere in the spinning universe where innocence evaporates like moisture of our flesh. It is the genesis of all that is to come. A second spherical blob parachutes down, another sky-drenched soul kisses the parted lips of the furious soil. Rejected, the drop's surface tension is all that holds it into, and soon the pillory wave loses its molecules, cleaving what remains with physical bonds. It is nearly, but not quite, 1:23 now. Anointed, electric, we go forth now, to be fruitful, to multiply now. Thank you.
Mary O'Connor, she's right here.
Well, I've taken a parable and tried to apply it to the present day with a little different slant. This is called Moral Hazard. It didn't really happen. It's a parable. Five were foolish. Five were wise. The King James Bible called them virgins. More modern versions speak of girls, no doubt hedging their bets. We are used to bridesmaids accompanying the bride. What would the groom do with so many young things? No stag night in those days. Things had to be kosher. There are lots of puzzling questions, all a bit unfair. Number one. Why didn't the groom arrive on time? If he had, the lamps wouldn't need the extra oil. The guy was guilty of squandering a resource, not to mention damaging the environment. When news came that he was finally on his way, the ten were drowsy. Panic reigned as lamps were trimmed. The foolish ones asked their more savvy counterparts to share the flasks of oil they had in their possession. They were met with blank refusal. A case of what we have, we hold. Even down to the present day, oil has regularly been a bone of contention. No doubt the clever five thought giving their precious oil to a bunch of gormless girls would only encourage their irresponsibility and wayward ways. measure to teach such scatterbrains a lesson. Maybe next time they'd be more circumspect and not rely on the kindness of strangers. Alas, as you can see, there was no kindness there. Where was the generosity of spirit that would recognize a need and answer it? The so-called wise ones, when all is said and done, were singularly lacking in the greatest virtue. While the others were away, the bridegroom came, swept into the feast with his prudent cohort, and closed the door. The others finally came back, begged to be let in, but were punished for being late, a fault that in the bridegroom's case was overlooked. He told them through the door he did not know them. The moral of this sorry tale is be prepared. Maybe it's better to draw your own conclusions.
That's the last part. Just a watch.
For the arrival. When you arrive at your destination, let me know, for I more than likely would throw a party in your honour. We have pledged to keep these moral values close to our hearts. There are other things enabling us to press forward into a little unknown. Someone from culture forces to live above and beyond the call of duty. Depending on how we find ourselves, after a moment that beckons, with that smooth skin and a sweet voice, and cupid bow lips that jump at you and catch you too. Let me know when you are finished, for I, standing alone, am still hungry and still waiting for you to arrive. This is my temper of planet. Though I first feel more temperamental, things seem to cruise me by the back bar. A wild card played in most situations, a wanton, woebegone, wandering stare. She walks among devils at a fighting pace, and grimaces with pleasure for no reason. Grows more butchery in passing the season, that falls upon her charming face. All this to get her away from the confusion, that takes her hand but fails to lead her down to a more convenient path to fusion, with conventional looks before she concedes. Dancing eventually with her own kind, she will finally achieve the state of mind. Thanks.
Noel O'Callaghan.
Noel. Good evening, everyone. Look, this is a poem that I wrote about 15 years ago, and I'll tell you why, it's 15 years old, but when I entered it into the Cork Alibo, I got 30 points for it. Okay? No. It's the happy days of my youth. Mount Vernon Terrace was where I was reared. For me, there's nowhere that can be compared. Where friends stood together through thick and through thin, never showed a white feather and never gave in. When times they were hard and times they were tough, we battled it through with the smooth and the rough. Solidarity our motto, the name of the game, our principles were sacred and not for sale. I remember the bonfires on St. John's night, where we held hands and sang songs till the dawn's early light. On St. Stephen's Day, we went out on the Ran, we knocked on doors and stuck out our can. We would go down the glen to play a match, and after the game, have a swim in the hatch. After our swim, we would bam out on the grass and admire and chat up any girls as they pass. We would pluck up the courage and ask for a date, and promise we would not keep them out late. And if they agreed, we would meet them that night and go for a scove up to the Maldives. At the end of the terrace, we enjoyed playing ball, until the girls came along and put a stop to it all. After Mass on Sunday, we played Brag and Pontoon and a score of bowls in the afternoon. After the score, if we won some money, we would go dancing that night and get a shift if we were lucky. Those were great times we used to share wherever we went without a care. Many are dead now, but some still survive and find memories for us that keep us alive. So here's to Mount Vernon on top of the hill. God bless our friends who live up there still.
Sean Kelly.
This poem is called Argument. You lie in your sight, a wider than usual strip of mattress divides it. We know by now how these dead hours pass. For 30 years, Abelard the Dominican copied books by day and sighed his tiresome prayers at night. Every moment in between, he pictured Eloise growing old behind convent walls and ached like a schoolboy for the parts of her he never touched. One nearly senile midnight, he shambled out in a blizzard to die a mile nearer her bed and learned at last that love falls like snow on the dead. That gallery afternoon, we tramped past endless red-faced generals in Napoleon hats, dozens of crucifixions under the same ominous sky, and found our way to the long high rooms filled with Degas sketches of dancers, dancers, dancers.
The five world champions, Simon Deacon.
Called cork. I've heard it said that it is because of the holes that a cork floats. I'd love to believe that. That by taking pieces out of something, a space is made and the emptiness left. It allows for something else. Something that staves off the sinking, and subsequently the possibility of salvation stays through days and gives hope. A reason to remain falling as we do above and below the surface. The Ugandan man standing on Pana bellows, Eko! To the crows looking down above Duns. He sees me smiling at him as I pass. He looks back, I go by. All right, boy, he says, smiling, wondering on warm, as if a twin to me. Windows reflect widows of the 50s, recently redefined, black on black lapping, a young one done, doing as she's told by the streets that's shouting at her, doing as she's told, playing as young as we let her, since he dropped in the garden last week. Before her, a 20-something Hepburn light, flowers on her sails, moved by tights upon thighs and the calves and the ankles and heels and the sheen and the promise, the clue and the mystery and beauty and the youth floating, floating, floating.
Gaffney was a cobbler with a bad leg, and nobody else I knew spoke as fast as him. I never knew what had happened, but he built his house himself, and raised his family with that bad leg, and he made his own shoes, and he mended everyone else's shoes, and he cut hair, and sold top coats, and car radios to farmers, and went to football matches, and funerals, and removals, and bingo, the length and breadth of the country, all with that bad leg. But some people never collected their shoes, and his shop was full of old shoes. But he knew where every shoe was, and he also knew who owned every shoe. And after squeezing through the dark corridor stacked full of black men's suits and topcoats, Tom was at his bench inside the window, surrounded by a sea of shoes, gluing or hammering, quick, short taps, or pointing with his crutch to a spot under a pile of shoes where a pair lay buried for 5 years. That woman never came back, never came back, never came back. He'd fire rapidly between taps of the hammer when you'd hold aloft to sandal in search of your own. Or he might be shaving the head of a countryman sitting in his chair with the electric trimmers. He'd shave the one side first, him half standing, half sitting with his butt propped on the bench. And then he'd move around, hobbling over shoes, dragging a loose trouser leg with a shoe attached to the end of it, and reposition himself propped on the crutch, using the man's head for something to hold on to, before tackling the other side. And when it was done, he'd send the countryman off saying, "Tell them Tom Gaffney gives a good haircut, gives a good haircut, gives a good haircut." I never went to Tom for a haircut after I witnessed what he did to the countryman. I'd go to Mr. McGurl in the little red oxide tin hut beside the bridge and under the big chestnut tree that hung out over the road. It had a small door and one window. Mr. McGurl would put me sitting on a stool a mile off the ground. The timber seat was shiny and arse polished, and I'd have to hold on to stay in it. For sitting quiet, I got a lollipop that bits of clipped hair stuck to and annoyed me. But the countrymen were happy with their haircuts, and on summer Sundays, content with the hay saved, they all sat on the left side of the church under the gallery with brown necks, washed and scrubbed, and their Tom Gaffney haircuts. When I went down to a shop, Tom always greeted me the same way. "Who you, tap tap, who you, tap tap, who you, tap tap," he'd say, moving the shoe around on the last. And before I could answer, he'd say rapidly, "Son of Ned Max, tap tap, son of Ned Max, tap tap, son of Ned Max, tap tap," as he turned the last around on his lap and the leather apron covered in scabs of gone off glue, which wasn't true tap tap, which wasn't true tap tap, which wasn't true tap tap. I sang in my head, because Ned Mac had ne'er a child, and everyone knew it, and I thought it was strange how Tom didn't know it. And he'd swivel the heel on the last, tapping in tacks, tap tap, the smallest nails he'd ever seen, tap tap, lost between his black blue smeared thumb and forefinger. He always seemed to hit his thumb several times before a movement and give his final tap tap and shouting, "Top of the house, 9-0! Top of the house, 9-0! Tap tap. Then he'd briskly wipe excess glue off his hand onto his leather apron and prod a switch on the wall and start up the machine with the round brushes, the belt slapping and squealing and shuddering until it picked up speed and settled into a hum to smooth off the rough edges of the new heel and polish up the shoe. But he asked me that every time I went down to get a shoe mended. "Who you, who you, who you?" But he always knew which shoes were mine, and I couldn't understand that. And Tom had the same haircut as he gave the farmers, and I used to wonder about that too. Who gave Tom Gaffney his haircut?
Someone's calling for another poem down here. What's your name?
Taj. Recently, somebody said to me that there's a census of 1901 available online, and I went on it to look and see all of my people. I came across, there's a name in the family that's always been somebody, my father's a sister called Nora, and he's an aunt called Nora, but I'd never heard of her, but she was on the 1901 census. And there were paintings in my grandmother's house, and I never knew who did them, but I recently found out that she did them. I asked an aunt tonight. So this is called 1901 census, and Sister Nora painted parrots in Grishan Convent, and camels too, all mostly exotic, with sunsets imagined in African deserts, devoted her young life to Christ, broke bread, their wine, his blood, died in a convent, buried in a communal grave, in Bordeaux, France, almost forgotten. Thanks.
She
just got herself on the list, Jean Curtain.
My heart's wandering, and so the secrets are bound up in the city. Its ancient hills, cold every point, and rolled softly, show the key of the school, walk calmly on hill and harbor. And second one is the poem I'm working on, and I got it over the summer, and just I'll give you the kind of second last version of it. Portrait. Shards of pottery, traces, shapes, delicate, broken, from the palaces of Minoan Crete and Mycenae to the Gothic spires of Golden Earth.
Jean was the last on the list, but I'm presuming that Alan has something. Does he? He always has his homework done, does he?
Just in case. Actually, this is when I'm not involved in kind of heavy academic, profound work. I write for kids as well, and I wrote a short novel for kids some years ago called Amach in Irish, and I've been asked to translate it for a short book. So I'll read the short bit in Irish, and then I'll read the bit of a translation that I've done so far, if you have the patience. This is the start of an Irish. Come with us a dull or some of all his dumbness may enact in British, a mach or submission. Come with a mach or shisha, ta mach on a boor. A mach on chin or submission, but there are she the gum with her own stride, toss a good. Need is a gum or shisha, need is a gum or horrible. Ach, he is a gum and chin the mach, ne keshna tach with rug. Kill us a metu of bad, kill it a yawn. Hold to the law and violet, with a phone poker that, kick on a fan for a stick. You're visiting on public counter in the kitchen, shin the dragon on your douche. The Abrishin, your dragon on the counter, bill called. Hrammy Mahuili, Hrammy Mahuili, Hrammy Mahuili, the American Gifford and the Adon, Palisha. And in English, it goes like this. Out of Mach. Where are you going? My mother asked just when I was at the door. Out, I said. Where's out? She said. Out is very big. Out there, I said, pointing my finger out there towards the road, you know, like, out. I don't know, she said, I don't know at all, at all. And then I knew the questions would come out thick and fast, more thick than fast. Who will you be out with? Will you be out long? Who else will be there? Are you going out into the centre? Do you have your mobile? Why don't you just stay at home? I didn't know which one of these questions I should answer first, therefore, I didn't answer any. I shrugged my shoulders, put my hands in my pockets, wait for the rest of the rant, then it came out. Why don't you do some study? You're way behind in the class. I'd be disgraced when I see your teacher. Don't you have a project to do? If you're half as good at your lessons and you aren't going out, you'll be the best boy in the class. Her mouth was wobbling. Sometimes I was afraid that her false teeth would fall out. They were hammering together like a pair of drums. A tune came to my head just then. The tune bobbed along in time with her mouth and her chattering teeth. When the rhythm stopped, I knew I was safe. Out I went. All the world was there laid out before me. Who knows who would be there before me, out at the end of the street, or across the fields. I imagined out there pirates and wild animals, but it was only Govdaw and his sister. Govdaw was my best friend. One of his ears was higher up than the other, out on the top of his head. He had a mop of hair that a miracle couldn't cure, and he was always scratching his bum. This surprised me, as he had no nails on his fingers. That was because they were always inside his pockets. He kept a supply always. Any time he became scared, he would take out some and start chewing or sucking them in his teeth. He said he would never put his thumb in his mouth when he was a baby. He's making up for it now and couldn't take it out. Also, there was also a bit of a drip out of his nose, summer and winter. I don't know whether I really liked his sister or not. When she hung out with us, I liked it. She was just like a boy. But other times she turned out to be a real bitch and she put on a face. I'd no patience with that. But then again, she let out a laugh that made the whole street stop in its tracks. When she was like that, I never knew what to make out of her. Her name was Gráinne. We always called her Grung. I've no idea why. Hi, said Govdaw, what do we do? Follow me, I said, and I turned out towards a river. I'd no idea where we were going, but I thought we could mess around at the river. Groom didn't really like to hang out there, as it was mostly boys. Maybe she would just buzz off soon, or maybe she wouldn't, who knows. There was a gang out at the river. Snot was in charge. He wasn't a very nice guy, but he had his own followers. He had a frog in the palm of his paw, and he had a straw stuck up its butt. Look at this, he shouted out to us all. He started blowing into the straw. I think I was disgusted, but I was still fascinated. I saw this thing done before, but it's still better than any film. I looked at Gobdaw's face, but I couldn't make out what was going on in his head. Groom's eyes were bulging out of her head, and I think she was enjoying it. Suddenly, the frog exploded. Sploosh! Yellow and green and red and brown and gum splattered out all over the place. My own jacket was covered in glob. If there were bits all over Gobdaw's jacket, we couldn't tell the difference. Everything from his neck down and out was a kind of green and yellow anyway. Groom was forcing her hole laughing and dancing for joy. I'm going out swimming, Snot said suddenly. He stripped off down to his underpants and jumped out into the water. Nobody wanted to follow him as the water was murky and dirty and dark. People often fished further up the river, but here he would only catch old shoes and broken television sets. Are none of you coming, he said, when he surfaced with a plastic supermarket bag around his ear. I come, shouted Groom, but Snot never heard her as he vanished out of sight again. Don't be an idiot, said Gobdaw, and he rarely said anything. You can't swim properly, and I'm not going to dry you. He took another fingernail out of his pocket and started chewing it. You're not my father, she said bitterly. Don't you be giving out to me and telling me what to do. She had a face on that I only ever saw in horror films, and one of her teeth turned purple with rage. She started stripping. I looked away out over the bushes, but I don't know why. Then she was there, out before us, ready to go. Her skin looked to me as white as stuff from above to below. Just a vest and white panties, white as stuff. She stood on the edge of the water and looked in. I'm coming, she shouted. Where are yous? She got no answer straight away. She stared at the water. You think she was trying to find out the right place to jump in. It looked all the same to me. Where are you? She shouted out again. Her voice raised just a bit. Just that bit that said she wasn't sure she'd get an answer. He's down there too long, she said, turning to us. He should be up and out by now. I looked out at the surface of the water. There was nothing stirring there. I felt that things were happening deep down, but it was only feeling. There were shadows down there, but maybe they were only the shadows of the shadows above us, glowering out in the water. I'm afraid, Groom said. Nobody can stay down that long, not even him. Her face was whiter than stuff now, as white as cold. There were years crawling across her face. Gobdaw's chin was kissing his chest, and I thought his hair was greying out. I jumped out across and in. If I knew why I did it, I was soon sorry. The water was piss cold and it was dark. Dark at the beginning anyway. Slowly things began to be murky clear. A toy pram from the Stone Age. A doll staring out at me through big blue glassy eyes. Books floating by like floppy fish. The seat of a car. A steering wheel. A big lumpy mattress. A dead gollywog. A face with no body. What looked like a rat. A legless Superman. A bit of a camel. A shape that was still vomiting. A CD with a bite out of it. A forgotten sandwich. A thing. Some kind of yolk. Maybe a giant rusty tomato. A hairy fairy. A mammoth tooth. A brush with no leg. Plastic bags full of rubbish. And on it goes. Next week.